loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about whether the U.S. government will shut down or whether the Democrats, the Republicans, and the Trump White House will come to a deal. Next, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson backpedaled yesterday on U.S. plans for Syria's border with Turkey, saying that the United States would not arm a Kurdish border army and added that the U.S. owes Turkey an explanation. Tillerson said further that the U.S. plans to maintain a military force inside Syria even after ISIS is defeated. In our second hour, we look at five stories. President Trump is set to address by satellite Friday's so-called March for Life, the annual anti-choice, anti-abortion gathering that is gaining new ground under the Trump administration. Next, Acting Director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Mike Mulvaney, has requested no funding, that is zero funding, for the next quarter. This is after his announcement on Tuesday that the agency will delay and revisit regulations on payday lending, a predatory system long understood to target the poor. Next, we turn to Indiana. A little more than a year after then-President-elect Donald Trump stood before cheering workers at a Carrier manufacturing plant in Indiana and promised to keep their Rust Belt jobs from moving to China, those same workers are feeling betrayed as more than 1,500 have been laid off, the final 200 just this week. Our next story, members of the Catalonia Parliament elected a separatist as speaker yesterday in their first meeting since the central government in Madrid dissolved the region's parliament. And our final story, more than 120 prisoners took control of a French prison outside of Paris in response to a demonstration by hundreds of prison guards a day earlier, during which guards burned tires and wooden pallets in protest against a rise in inmate violence, insufficient staff, and a lack of resources. We'll talk about all of this on today's Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the issue of a possible government shutdown. The government is heading directly for a shutdown as Senate Republicans admit that they do not have the votes to extend federal funding, even for the short term. What will this mean for the Dreamers, for those who have been given relief under President Obama, the 800,000 to 1 million young people who came here as undocumented children way back when and have been here for sometimes decades? Meanwhile, President Trump tweeted today that the Children's Health Insurance Plan, CHIP, should not be part of the continuing resolution, but instead should be part of a long-term solution along with his border wall. We are joined by Brent Wilkes. He is the National Executive Director of the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, the country's oldest and largest Hispanic organization. Welcome, Brent.
It's great to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, the stakes here are high. Of course, there's a kind of titillation that takes place inside the Beltway about whether a government will shut down, won't shut down. But let's talk about the actual human cost of these events, especially as it comes to DACA, comes to immigration reform, comes to CHIP, and of course, what the impact would be if a government actually does shut down. Go ahead, if you would.
Sure. So there are over 800,000 students that have received the DACA protections and are currently working legally and are protected from deportation, although about 120 a day lose that protection. And on March the 5th, all of them will lose the protection. And we think this, of course, is a terrible policy. It would revert all these students back to undocumented status. They would lose their jobs, and about 90% are either going to college or working. And it would dramatically impact our economy in a negative way. So beyond just the human costs, it hurts us economically to do this. And these students are, exceptional individuals. They've done nothing wrong. They were brought by their parents to the United States when they were minors. And so they really haven't broken any laws at all. And we think that there's a solid majority of Americans, including a majority of Republicans, that support helping the DACA students and passing the DREAM Act. if the DREAM Act were to pass, about 2 million young people that are in the same category would be able to benefit from it. So it would be a huge win for young dreamers, and would give them a chance to get right with the law and to live the American dream like so many other young people.
Brent, the president has been all over the map, at least in his tweets, on this issue. But I'm looking at a piece in Yahoo News today saying that he actually had his chief of staff, General Kelly, meet with members of the Hispanic caucus. And then there was just a line and a half of news this morning saying that the president now believes that there may be a deal to be made. What do you make of this? Is it possible to pin this guy down on what he actually wants as a policy? And do you think that a president like Donald Trump would actually agree to turn around and fund DACA?
Yeah, I definitely do think that that there is a pathway to get President Trump to sign a DREAM Act that includes some of his enforcement priorities. And that's why there's a bipartisan bill in both the House and the Senate that would accomplish that. But I think that it's interesting. It is hard to pin him down. He seems to respond to whoever he spoke to last, which is, you know, very frustrating and difficult to move forward, because, you know, one minute you think you got a deal, and the next minute he's talked to a hardliner on his staff like Stephen Miller or some of the hardliners in Congress, and comes back and says, no, the deal's not good enough, that he just agreed to. So it's been terribly frustrating. What we're hearing is that the Republicans in Congress are saying, we're just going to move forward with our bipartisan deal and present it to the president. And then hopefully, of course, he'll sign it. So that's really the best they can do, because it's so hard to pin him down on what his intentions are. But I do think that, you know, depending on who talked to him last, he would support a deal that would help the Dreamers as well as include some of his enforcement priorities.
You know, I think you're onto something, frankly. Again, I'm looking at this Yahoo piece, and it says very specifically, multiple sources who were present at the meeting, and this is the meeting between President Trump and members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, said that Trump is willing to sign off on a DACA fix, but only if it is paired with stepped up border security measures. Well, that's nothing new. He's been saying that for at least a week, maybe longer than a week. Here's a quote. He made it very clear. This is General Kelly. He made it very clear that the president has become sympathetic to DACA, Kelly said multiple times. He said that the president wants to sign a bill that keeps the Dreamers in the country, added a staffer for a member of the caucus who was present for the meeting. However, General Kelly also said the White House will not sign a bill for the Dreamers alone, a clean DACA. It needs to be packaged with border security. This may be a situation, Brian, where it's really face-saving for him. This is what he's looking for, to not look like a fool to his base, where he's willing to concede DACA, because frankly, he's never really felt very strongly one way or the other about DACA. But he really does feel strongly about that wall.
Yeah, and by feeling strongly, I think we have to put it into perspective that, yeah. Well, at least my own interpretation is that everything Donald Trump is doing is not based on some sort of foundational
values.
Absolutely
not.
I mean, all of this is kind of his political presentation. He went so far as to win the Republican nomination and then the presidency using this kind of anti-immigrant rhetoric, anti-Mexican rhetoric, yep. Build the wall, make Mexico pay for it, all of this kind of hubris. So he's kind of talked himself into a corner. And at the same time, it doesn't seem to me, and I want to get your impression, Brent, that if the deal doesn't go through, if there is no deal, which, you know, even this morning, it looked like there's not going to be a deal, and thus the government would shut down, President Trump would feel just as comfortable with blaming the Democrats for the shutdown, and rather than sort of compromise or look like he's conceding to the Latino or immigrant communities in front of his base. Anyway, your view.
Well, I think that the public, there's been some polling already, they would pin this on Donald Trump that if the government were to shut down. And it's basically because he's vacillated so much and he's been so difficult to negotiate with. I mean, here's a guy who gets elected saying he's the best negotiator in the world, and yet he doesn't seem to be able to actually stick to his negotiating points. So, you know, you think you got a deal and then he changes it, which is maybe that's what he meant by being the best negotiator. But I don't think the public is going to give him a break. And, you know, we've seen now that since his election, the Republican Party is really taking a nosedive in terms of popularity and in terms of some of these special elections that have been held. And I think he's over thinking his hand here, that that he's in serious trouble, his party's in serious trouble. It's because of this erratic behavior that he's got. He'd do himself a huge favor if he just agreed to the bipartisan deal, gave up this idea that somehow that being the biggest anti-immigrant in the room is playing to his base, and realize that it's time to step up and be the president and be the leader of this country and do the right thing. A thing that he publicly has said that he supports, which is, you would think that that would be enough. Just the fact that he said he wanted to pass the DREAM Act himself. And here we have both the DREAM Act and some of his enforcement priorities. Why isn't that enough to get the deal done? It's hard to understand, but the public is going to blame Donald Trump if there is a shutdown. But I have to say, we think the momentum is on our side. There seems to be a growing bipartisan consensus in both the House and the Senate passing the DREAM Act is the right thing. They just have to kind of get down to the very particulars on the enforcement side of the deal and get everybody's agreement on that. They may have run out of time to do that, but stranger things have happened. And I think we're on the Hill right now with our 150 Dreamers, and we think that we have a good shot at getting at least an agreement in principle before Friday's deadline on the shutdown.
And would this manifest in a continuing resolution, in other words, a stopgap spending measure or something greater?
If there's a deal in principle that everybody's agreed to, then you could see something like a 48-hour or a little bit longer, maybe a three-day CR, just to give the time to vote on the deal. So I don't think Democrats will, basically vote against a 36-hour, 48-hour or three-day CR if the deal's been agreed to. But they need to agree to a deal in principle. There's legislation in both the House and Senate now, so they've got the legislation. They may not have time to actually vote on it, and I think that's where there's some wiggle room here to get a deal done, to keep the government open, and then give them another 3 days or so to actually pass the bill and get it to the president's desk.
I think that's right. We have Democrats just lining up to oppose a longer CR, provided that
CR is continuing resolution.
Provided that DACA is not in it. If DACA is in it and they need another day or two or five to negotiate a longer term deal or even an actual bill, then, it's hard to vote against something like that.
Now, Donald Trump is also Brent Wilkes. Brent Wilkes is our guest. He is the National Executive Director of the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, the country's oldest and largest Hispanic organization. And Brent, you're here in Washington, D.C. You say your people and the Dreamers are up on the Hill at the House of Representatives, at the Senate. Obviously, they've also been in the streets carrying out very dramatic protests in recent days and recent weeks, and actually for the last few years, which is why this has all come to pass. Actually, it's the initiative and the bravery and the advocacy of the Dreamers themselves and the larger immigrant and Latino communities that have made this possible. If what you're suggesting to us, though, is that the Republicans and the Democrats come to an agreement in the House and in the Senate, they then sort of present to Donald Trump a fait accompli from them, that would put the onus on him to say no rather than the Republicans and Trump saying no to the Democrats on this, that, or the other thing, or vice versa. That creates the political calculation or the political calculus whereby Trump signs it. What happens then to one DACA? Okay. What about comprehensive immigration reform? Would we see that in that kind of bipartisan bill? And what would happen, because it's also big on the agenda and big in the media and, of course, big for millions of families, the childhood health plan?
Well, so the childhood health plan definitely will pass. So I think that's going to happen. In fact, Republicans have tried to attach it to their CR, so they've kind of already agreed we'll get the CHIP program done. But in terms of the longer term immigration reform, I would have told you a week ago, no way is that going to happen under this president. But he did meet with Democrats and Republicans and said that, we'll pass the DREAM Act and then an hour later we'll start working on comprehensive reform. So who knows? I mean, it really seems to depend on who he's talked to last. But I do think that that it also depends upon what's in the DACA package. The Senate and the House differ pretty significantly because in the Senate, they have a program to legalize the parents of Dreamers as well. Up to 3 million people would be able to take advantage of them. Half of them could get on a pathway to citizenship, and the other half would end up being on these 3-year temporary permits. But if that were to take place and you add the two together, you're now at 5 million of the 11 million undocumented people that would be able to participate in the program. And that might be probably enough for this Congress to get done and make it unlikely for them to pursue a broader comprehensive immigration reform.
But these are kind of important pieces of information, John. So I want Brent to really go over that again, because that would be a big deal. So, Brent, you're suggesting that not only the Dreamers, but their parents, and of course, there's been efforts in the past to provide relief for the parents. President Obama tried to do it. The courts ruled against him, I believe, and that on the basis of whether he had overstepped executive authority. So just go over it again. So do you believe that that kind of a deal will be acceptable? Obviously, the Democrats would accept it. Will the Republicans actually do this?
Well, surprisingly, there are some Democrats that are concerned about the deal for the parents, because the half that get the temporary work permits, that's a lot like the DAPA program that got struck down by the Supreme Court. But basically, that piece of it was added to get to this kind of chain migration bullet point that the president has, you know, spoken about, where he said it has to include ending chain migration. And so what that basically is saying is that, yes, we're going to legalize the Dreamers, and yes, they'll be on a pathway to citizenship, but no, they won't be able to sponsor their parents once they become permanent legal residents or even citizens. And so that 1.5 million parents that came into the country without inspection, they would end up just being on these temporary visas that are 3 years, renewable forever, theoretically, as long as they want to stay in the United States. However, they would be able to adjust. I'm not sure if all the Democrats realize, but they would be able to adjust if they have another avenue. So perhaps an employer wants to sponsor them, or they get married to a U.S. citizen, they could adjust that way. I think that the other half of the Dreamer parents that came in with inspection, so these are people who overstayed their visas, they would actually be able to be sponsored by their children once they became legalized. So that's they would be better off. And I think the Democrats are okay with that, but they are concerned about this new category, because once you start creating different types of citizenship, you know, where this citizen can sponsor their parents, but this citizen can't, you're suddenly creating second-class citizenship in the United States, and people are really concerned about that.
You are creating a second class of citizens. At the same time, at least in the short term, I wonder if the idea that Democrats could argue that families would be left intact, that might be worth a yes vote in the short term. But then what about some of these people that we've seen in these high-profile deportations over the last couple of weeks? Is there any provision, or do you think there could be any provision that would allow people who have been deported, who otherwise would have qualified for this kind of a program if it's enacted, to return to the United States?
Yeah, I haven't seen that. That's really hard to go back and, in essence, undeport people.
Right.
There are provisions about extreme hardship to a U.S. citizen child. So if you have a parent of a U.S. citizen who's deported, and the child is, you know, very young and needs the parent for care, they can make a case on a case-by-case basis to the courts. But I haven't seen anywhere in the legislation that would allow people who had already been deported. So that's really unfortunate. And that's an area where President Trump has a lot of discretion here. You know, President Obama had focused in on violent felons and people who were really a threat to U.S. citizens, to Americans, as his deportation priority. And, you know, admittedly, he deported quite a few people. President Trump now is just going after harmless immigrants who are working hard and contributing to our economy. And he's going into these workplace raids where I think they just raided some 7-Elevens. And he's threatened to do a lot more raids like that. And I think that's where you're hitting people who aren't really a threat, who are contributing to our economy, clearly, because they're working. And the question is, why is that a priority? But unfortunately, the way the law is written right now, the president has that authority and can, you know, redirect the focus of who they're trying to deport. And, you know, while he says he's always talking about crime and violent criminals and this and that, but then when he actually comes down to enforcement, he's he's deporting your neighbor who's working hard in the convenience store in the 7-Eleven, serving you and helping you with the things that you need and contributing to our economy. And so he's saying one thing and doing another.
Yeah, the rating of it's almost 100 7-Elevens in that one morning last week. I mean, that's also where you go around in this area, in the Washington, D.C. area, you go to Langley Park. The 7-Elevens are the place where day laborers gather. And that's where people come and they pick them up and they take them for day jobs. So raiding those folks means you're arresting people who are going to be hired, would be hired otherwise. I mean, it's just kind of a cruel, arbitrary effort to intimidate immigrant communities. It doesn't help anybody. It certainly rips apart families. And then we read, Brent, about the tragic story of Jorge Garcia in Detroit. He had come as a 10-year-old. He's now 40. He'd been here for 30 years. And deported, there he was at the airport, surrounded by his family, who were in turn surrounded by ICE agents. I mean, how does that stop crime? But that, in fact, is the kind of policy that's being implemented against immigrant communities all over the country.
Yeah, it's the human cost here is huge. There's no national interest in doing this. You're really actually hurting our economy by targeting individuals like that. And so the only policy objective seems to be as mean-spirited towards these individuals as possible. And, you know, I would have hoped that this country was better than that. Clearly, we've got some ways to go before we start treating people with dignity and respect. So it's hugely disheartening for us to see this, and we're doing everything we can to help them. But at the same time, you know, President Trump is the president, and if he wants to target individuals like that and deport them, that's his prerogative under the law as it stands. And so we just have to keep trying to appeal to him. And it's a tough appeal because, as you mentioned at the top of the show, this president was elected using some of the harshest rhetoric we've heard in decades, if not centuries. Coming from a U.S. president towards the immigrant population here in the United States. And whether he really believes it or not, who knows, but it doesn't really matter. The fact is that that's the language he's been using. He's whipping people up into actually thinking they're right to hate immigrants, which is awful. And we've seen hate crimes ticking up substantially against immigrant populations. And what is going to result is that these individuals are going to suffer. Their families are suffering. But we as a country are suffering because our economy is being hurt, and we're losing our moral high ground here. We used to be the land of the free and the home of the brave and the shining city on the hill, and now we're turning into a pretty ugly country with a very nationalist rhetoric.
I wanted to talk about that, too, and I wanted to turn to this notion of the wall. You know, during the campaign, Donald Trump's rhetoric was very clear. He talked about a big, beautiful wall, a tremendous wall. Mexico was going to pay for the wall. And now we're not talking about a wall as we might know it. In this meeting with General Kelly, the White House chief of staff, with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Kelly said that the administration would be satisfied with levee border walls, right? Which are just essentially dirt mounds, or even increased security at ports of entry without a physical wall. One member of the Hispanic caucus who attended the meeting said, and I'm quoting here, there are differences in terms of what that wall can be. He didn't come in and say the wall or nothing. I think it was quite far away from that. So are we seeing, Brent, some wiggle room here? Do you think that if Democrats move toward some idea of enhanced border security without it necessarily being a wall, do you think that might allow the Republicans to say that they then have the ability to concede a little bit and negotiate on these other issues?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, I think what Trump is trying to do, if there is a rational strategy here, is he's trying to pretend that he's getting his wall, and he's starting to enlarge what the wall means, and that's what Kelly was trying to do here. Is like, well, when we said wall, we didn't mean exactly
an actual wall.
Yeah. And so what I understand in this compromise legislation that's out there is that the the wall that they're talking about now is more like a fence. It does have concrete reinforcement, so it's a pretty serious fence. But they're talking about something that's got visibility through it, so small animals would be able to go back and forth, but people couldn't. And it's only going to be in areas that already has fencing or walls. So they're really looking at basically shoring up the existing border areas where there is fencing or walls, and not adding any more mileage to the amount of the border that's already fenced or walled off. So if I guess the best way to put this is President Trump wants to pivot and claim victory with that, then I guess we can go ahead and let him have his day.
It's an amazing commentary about political leadership that Trump's narcissism is such, and everyone has to kind of deal with it. And thus, in a way, it shows he's a lousy negotiator, too, because bottom line is, if you play to his narcissism or give him a little bit of something, he doesn't really care. You don't really know what his bottom line is, which is kind of fundamentally important to good negotiations. Because General Kelly said he was evolving on the issue, or he didn't, or they were changing the definition. Trump went crazy on Twitter. He said, the wall will be paid for. This was this morning, 7 hours ago. The wall will be paid for directly or indirectly or through longer-term reimbursement by Mexico, which has a ridiculous $71 billion trade surplus with the United States, which is completely...
total non sequitur.
Non sequitur. The $20 billion wall is peanuts compared to what Mexico makes from the U.S. NAFTA. It's a bad joke. I mean, this is the voice of the President of the United States. I wonder, Brent, when people in Mexico or the government in Mexico is hearing this, and they've heard a lot of this for the past 2 years, do they just filter it and say, well, that's just Trump spouting off, none of it really has actual meaning?
No, and I think Americans shouldn't make that mistake to think that Mexicans understand he's just kind of spouting off and we're good, we're still friends. They hate this guy with a passion, and they're going to hold it against all of us for allowing him to be in the White House and to act like this towards their country. So the damage that's being done to the U.S. reputation around the world, but especially in Mexico and other countries that he's kind of specifically singled out, as in Haiti and Africa, I guess, the whole continent.
And El Salvador.
And El Salvador. That is something that's going to last with us long after Trump's gone, and we're going to have to do a lot of repairing. We weren't necessarily everybody's favorite country to begin with, but now we're really... if you think about some of the bad actors in the world out there, that's the way Mexico and other people are looking at us. And they're not just saying it's Trump. They're saying it's the entire country because we did elect him. So, and then, of course, Mexico's history with the United States has long been fraught with tension. We actually invaded Mexico and forced them to cede half of their territory to the United States in the Mexican War, which is, what makes Saddam Hussein blush, the kind of land grab that we did there.
Very important.
And they never forgot that. They still honor the people who perished in that war. And, so even there's that history. And it's also painfully obvious to them. It's like the people that are coming from Mexico to the United States are largely in that territory that we took from them. So, why are we so upset that the land that used to be theirs has Mexicans in it? So I just think that... they look at what this president is saying and they hate him. And the president of Mexico himself has to be a bit more diplomatic because he's got to deal with us. But the people, they dislike President Trump with a passion.
All right. That is the voice of Brent Wilkes. He is the National Executive Director of the League of United Latin American Citizens, the country's oldest and largest Hispanic organization. You may know it as LULAC. He's been talking to us from Washington, D.C., on the eve of what might or might not be a government shutdown. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson backpedaled yesterday on U.S. plans for Syria's border with Turkey, saying that the U.S. would not arm a Kurdish border army and added that the U.S. owes Turkey an explanation. Tillerson said further that the U.S. plans to maintain a military force inside Syria even after ISIS is defeated. We are joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former U.K. ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, Ambassador Ford.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a roly-poly couple of days here. We don't know what's going on. Is the United States creating a border army force? In other words, along the Turkey Syrian northern border, the northern border for Syria, certainly, or is Rex Tillerson walking that back? In other words, what's the reality?
Well, I suspect that what's happening here is that it's being realized in the State Department that they need a different rationale for the presence of U.S. advisors and other forces in those Kurdish-controlled areas. Now that ISIS are 99% eradicated from those areas. And so some bright spark came up with the idea, hey, why don't we say we're turning this force of ours, this Kurdish militia that we've been supporting, we'll rebrand them as a border guard force. Isn't that brilliant? Ah, but then, forgot the Turks. So roll back quickly, guys.
Yeah, somebody forgot to tell the Turks. Tillerson was giving a talk with Condoleezza Rice yesterday at Stanford University. And when somebody asked him about this border force, his response was just priceless. He said, that entire situation has been misportrayed, misdescribed. Some people misspoke. We are not creating a border security force at all. And then when the reporter said, well, the Turks are pretty angry at the reports that you are creating a border force and that it'll be made up of Kurds, he said, well, we understand why they reacted the way they did. I've never seen backpedaling like this before. This is pretty dramatic. And Ambassador Ford, I'd like to get your comment on something else. Rex Tillerson told CNN today that he follows policy pronouncements by having his staff print out the president's tweets every morning.
That's the way empires are supposed to be governed.
I mean, is that really the way you conduct foreign policy? I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but I've never experienced anything like this before.
You're not alone.
It is absolutely weird. I mean, I almost feel sorry for Tillerson.
I do too, frankly.
The guy can't be all bad. He called Trump a moron, so you know, Tillerson is the good guy here, relatively. And he's got a very difficult job to keep the Donald somehow in check and indeed to keep up with the Donald.
We've got an interesting situation here, Brian. You've got the president saying there's going to be a border security force. You have Tillerson saying there's not. And then Tillerson, as it turned out, says that he called Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to make sure that he was correct, that there's not going to be a border security force. And Mattis confirmed that, no, there's not going to be any border security force. Someone apparently forgot to tell the coalition in Syria because they've already recruited, according to the Washington Post, 230 cadets to be trained in order to be the first soldiers
but
in this new security force.
But the reports were that this was going to be a force of 30,000.
Right, 30,000. So 230 have been recruited against the 30,000 that were planned,
so
that it turns out weren't planned in the first place.
29,270 to go or something like that. We're almost there. We're almost there. But on a serious note, Ambassador Ford, we were really, I mean, this week here at Loud and Clear and others who are watching the news, the statements, the strident statements from the Turkish leadership, from Erdogan, really, in essence, condemning the United States for going forward with this plan, creating what must be within Turkey an additional sort of nationalist fervor against the United States, the NATO, the leader of NATO, and of course, Turkey is NATO's eastern flank. The idea that Turkey might be about to send in a military force that would have it clashing with U.S.-backed Kurds, so two different parts of NATO potentially fighting, all of those kind of scenarios seem to be an ever-present possibility just a couple of days ago. And then you have the Secretary of State, and now confirmed by the Secretary of Defense, saying no such thing. It just makes you wonder whether or not this was a miscommunication or whether there is, in fact, a debate going on within the Trump administration or within the summits of the U.S. establishment over what to do about Syria. Which is it?
I believe that the administration is not united. It's the administration which is fragmented as much as Syria is fragmented physically. And there are divided councils between the Pentagon and State and the White House. And there's general confusion all around as a result. And maybe we can come on to this, but I think Tillerson's Stanford's speech betrays the existence of these internal differences.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Then it would sound like if there's an internal difference, the winning side here seems to be the Tillerson side.
Right.
Because this is kind of categorical denials, right?
You know, and another thing that Tillerson and Mattis et al. Can do is what I like to call slow rolling. They just delay and delay and say, yes, Mr. President, yes, we're on that. It's going to happen, Mr. President, and just keep delaying until it goes away. Either the president is going to change his mind or the situation on the ground is going to change and the whole policy will be overtaken by events. Or there's a new president and everybody in the current administration just goes home. So they can agree with the president and say, yes, sir, we're implementing this policy that they hate. And in fact, they're actually not implementing the policy. And that makes the Turks happy.
I'm not sure this was actually a Trump policy to create this border force or a Pentagon policy. I suspect it's more that the Pentagon and maybe Trump bought it off Mattis as he buys just about everything. But this is the Pentagon are the hardliners here who really want to partition Syria and keep Syria destabilized and creating a statelet Kurdish-dominated, U.S.-dominated in that northern corner makes sense to them. But I suspect that the White House and State are thinking a little bit more deeply, a little bit more long-term. And this comes out in the Tillerson-Stanford speech, where he articulates at least some kind of vision of the way forward, even if it's largely nonsensical. At least it does show traces of realism.
You know, and this also points to the danger, Brian, of having so many generals and former generals in almost every major position of authority, at least related to national security. You end up with an echo chamber and nobody from the outside, except in this case for Rex Tillerson, who may or may not have the wherewithal to stand up to some of these guys. But it really shows how a policy can be perverted.
If we look at that speech a little bit more carefully, too, Tillerson is saying we're not going to create a border army, a border force. It's been mis-explained, misdirected, miss, whatever all those misses were. But he does say that the U.S. is going to stay in Syria.
Indefinitely.
He does say that, and he uses, as he must, because it's obviously an illegal intervention in Syria. Syria has not invited the United States. The U.N. Security Council has not authorized the United States to use military force in Syria. This is an illegal intervention, and yet the determination by the American government is to stay there. So he said, although I'm reading again from The Guardian, although he denied that the United States was about to embark once more on nation building, Tillerson acknowledged that as long as Syrian refugees did not feel safe enough to go home, the Syrian conflict would continue to destabilize the Middle East and Europe. Thus, the U.S. presence would also be geared to creating the conditions for safe return. So now a whole new explanation. It's again, America must stay uninvited illegally in a sovereign country so that the people from the sovereign country who have been driven out by a U.S. proxy war can come back and live safely. I mean, it's so perverse in terms of its rationalization. But nonetheless, here you have Tillerson, who might be considered the dove part of the U.S. establishment, providing such a ridiculous rationale for a continued illegal U.S. presence in Syria.
Ambassador Ford, I'm wondering, in your experience, is there any legal rationale? Is there anything that a country can, let's say, take to the United Nations that could justify maintaining a presence in a sovereign country where they have not been invited?
Only a mandate from the United Nations Security Council could trump the will of a sovereign member of the United Nations. And that is obviously not the case here. There is absolutely no mandate from the United Nations. No, there's no two ways about this. The U.S. presence is a total act of international illegality. But you know what? At the end of the day, what matters here is might. Might is right. In the international jungle, international law is often mocked. And the Tillerson speech doesn't even make any attempt to justify the U.S. plan to stay in Syria on any legal basis. Might is right.
That's an important point, Brian. No one in this administration has attempted to argue the legality.
According to the United States, the laws actually only apply to other countries. I mean, that's the de facto thinking in Washington, and everyone, in a way, kind of knows it. Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm in studio with John Kiriakou. We're talking about the shifting position or shifting pronouncements about the U.S. position in Syria. And we're talking with Ambassador Peter Ford, who was the U.K. ambassador to Syria. I want to go back again to the Guardian article and read a passage to you, Ambassador Ford, and have you comment on it. The UN Special Syria Envoy, Stephane de Mistura, announced he is convening 2 days of talks between the regime, that's the Syrian government, and the opposition in Vienna on Thursday and Friday of next week in a move designed to test the willingness of the Syrian government delegation to negotiate. In a statement, Mistura said he expected both sides to have, quote, substantive engagement, close quote, with him. What's going to happen in Vienna?
Well, I suspect that both sides will attend and they'll quickly get bogged down in detail about possible amendments to the Syrian constitution. I would be surprised if the Russians allowed the Syrian government to flounce out. No, they'll have to play along a little bit with this because we've got a big event coming up in a matter of days in Sochi, when the Syrian National Dialogue Congress will be convened by Russia. This is the big one. Vienna is just a minor prelude. And what's likely to happen in Sochi is that hundreds of Syrian delegates will attend, not just the so-called official opposition, but the Kurds and other ethnic groups and representatives for religious sects and tribes. And this coming together of Syrian peoples is going basically to trump the Geneva and Vienna process. Or this, at least, is the Russian hope. It was interesting that in Tillerson's Stanford speech, he did not once mention the opposition.
No, he did not. That's true.
Not one word, not once. Nor did he mention the armed groups, the jihadi groups that the Assad government has been fighting for 6 years. Both of these very important elements were totally airbrushed out of the picture. You just had, on the one hand, Assad brutally massacring his own people just for the hell of it, and the cavalry, the U.S. cavalry, was coming storming over the hill. But no, the non-mention of the opposition shows how, even in the U.S. estimation, this is not about helping the Syrian opposition or creating conditions of democracy in Syria. This is about asserting U.S. raw power.
In fact, he was actually clear about that, I think. In this speech at Stanford, he laid out five U.S. policy goals in Syria: the defeat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Who could argue against that, right? A UN-brokered resolution for Syria that involved Bashar al-Assad's departure, which is dramatic because it's regime change and there's no legal basis to call for regime change. The third, a curb on Iran, whatever that means. The fourth, conditions for the safe return of refugees. Everybody wants that. And finally, the complete elimination of remaining chemical weapons. That's a red herring. That makes it so that the United States and the UN can remain in Syria indefinitely under the guise of looking for chemical weapons or biological weapons that Bashar al-Assad ostensibly has and refuses to give up. We've seen this in Iraq. We saw this in Iraq over the last 25 years, and now we're seeing the beginning of it again in Syria, it seems to me. Ambassador Ford.
Yeah, we've seen this movie, and it doesn't have a happy ending. Lingering U.S. presence in Iraq was partly responsible for the emergence of ISIS and everything that followed. But, you know, I think Tillerson's speech will bear two interpretations. The hawkish one, which is the one that has been touted to the media, and there's a slightly less hawkish one, slightly more realistic one, which I suspect may be Tillerson's real thinking. Because again, it's as much what he doesn't say as what he does say that counts here. And what he doesn't say is that Sochi is a waste of time. This is a keystone of the Russian approach to get an internal settlement at Sochi, or over the months that will follow the Sochi meeting, that would then be endorsed by the international community at Geneva. You can read the Tillerson speech as going along with this Russian plan. And significantly, at one point towards the end of the speech, Tillerson said, we must move away from wishful thinking. Well, what wishful thinking is that? Wishful thinking that Assad can be removed by military means. But of course, there is also the superficial hawkish interpretation, which provides for indefinite U.S. presence in that part and other pockets of Syria. This keeps the Pentagon and maybe the White House happy. Either interpretation is possible.
I want to talk, Ambassador Ford, because you are an ambassador, about the state of U.S. diplomacy and the parts of U.S. diplomacy that are not really, I don't think, fully understood, and certainly not even illuminated slightly by the corporate-owned mainstream media. And let's go to Rex Tillerson himself. I mean, Tillerson was the CEO of ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil had its own State Department. I mean, before he became the U.S. Secretary of State, ExxonMobil has relationships with and independent of the State Department in countries all over the world, big and small. I want to go back to a New York Times piece from December 2016, read a couple sentences to you, and then comment on it, because there's a lot that's being made about the fact that Tillerson and the Trump administration, but he's the Secretary of State, is not filling the positions of ambassadors in countries all around the world. And there's some speculation that absent a U.S. ambassador in different countries, the big corporate entities like ExxonMobil, who have their own, in essence, diplomatic staff, don't have to deal with the American government. They have a direct line, no sort of middleman interlocutor. Here's the New York Times from December 2016. I want you to comment about this dynamic. Quote, struggling to keep Iraq from splintering, American diplomats pushed for a law in 2011 to share the country's oil wealth among its fractious regions. Then ExxonMobil showed up. Under its chief executive, Rex W. Tillerson, the giant oil company sidestepped Baghdad and Washington, signing a deal directly with the Kurdish administration in the country's north. The move undermined Iraq's central government, strengthen Kurdish independence ambitions, and contravene the stated goals of the United States. Mr. Tillerson's willingness to cut a deal regardless of the political consequences speaks volumes about ExxonMobil's influence. In the Iraq case, Mr. Tillerson and his company outmaneuvered the State Department, which he has now been nominated by President-elect Donald Trump to lead. It's an interesting dynamic, no?
It illustrates several things. One is that Tillerson is quite a canny operator, used to operating at stratospheric level and maneuvering and getting his way. The other is that he must have quite some knowledge of the Kurdish regions and the situation there, and he will be acutely aware that the Kurdish-controlled regions of Syria contain much of the admittedly limited oil and gas reserves in Syria. So he'll be very aware of that, and that's one of the reasons why he thinks that playing this Kurdish card in the end game, which will be upon us in a matter of months in Syria, why enhancing the Kurdish card because of the control over the oil reserves of Syria is important.
Yeah, ExxonMobil is the United States' biggest oil company. It has operations in six continents, a stock market value of more than $400 billion. John, in some ways, ExxonMobil is a state within a state.
It actually is. And we shouldn't underestimate Rex Tillerson's abilities. I mean, this is a major, major global corporation that he ran. And indeed, just weeks into his tenure as Secretary of State, he complained about how much more bureaucratic and slow-moving the State Department is compared to the way things were at Exxon. So the man certainly has abilities, and he has a familiarization with the world. As the ambassador pointed out, he ought to be pretty well acquainted with the Kurdish issue, because in Iraq, at least, and to a lesser extent in Syria, that is where much of the oil and gas is located. So we shouldn't underestimate him.
It's very interesting, and this came up in the speech in Stanford. Tillerson stressed that the American presence in the Kurdish regions is diplomatic and military. Now, in purely practical terms, it need only be military. What are diplomats doing in an area where there's no government to be accredited to, because they won't have anything to do with the Damascus government, and there is no Kurdish government to which they can be accredited, that there is no role for diplomats unless it's to stop the military guys having the run of the coup.
Right. Well, you know what? There's a precedent for that, and that's Iraq. That's exactly what the U.S. government did in Iraq. Is they sent an enormous State Department contingent into the Kurdish region, and it stayed there for years until it was able to help the Kurds to create an autonomous government. And I wonder if this is part of a long-term strategy where we're in Syria now and we have no plans to leave. None.
The U.S. never leaves.
No.
I mean,
that's what I'm
the
afraid
U.S.
of.
Is still in Germany and Japan, you know, 75 years later. Tillerson also has suffered not only victories but defeats as the head of ExxonMobil. Back in, I think it was 2007, 2008, Tillerson decided to take a hard-line position when Hugo Chavez and the Venezuelan government tried to renegotiate Venezuelan national oil contracts with the big oil producers, including ExxonMobil. The other foreign companies started to negotiate differently. Chavez was trying to take some of those oil revenues, redistribute it for poor people. They were the base of the Bolivarian Revolution. Rex Tillerson took a very hard line against Chavez. He said, we have our legal rights, we have our international rights, we have international courts to take this to. Just a harder line than all the other foreign oil companies. And Chavez just nationalized ExxonMobil. They lost everything in Venezuela at that time. And, you know, when you think about it, when you go through all the ups and downs of a CEO like Tillerson, who are not really coming from an ideological point of view. They're coming from a different point of view, sort of naked commercial or imperial interests in a way. There's a lot of lessons to be learned in these kind of battles. And I think Trump, for instance, or certainly the politicians in the U.S. Senate who oversee the State Department, they have far less experience in the real world. They don't have any responsibility either. They can just spout off all the time. It's an interesting dynamic. I wonder, though, under these circumstances, whether Rex Tillerson is long in the world of the Trump administration or whether these are some of the final acts. Do you have any feeling about that?
Well, your guess is probably better than mine.
John has
that.
A guess.
Or possibly Tillerson's own guess. Who knows what the Donald is going to come up with? Depends which side of the bed he gets out on any given day. Assuming that Tillerson does stay on, I suspect that the end game that Tillerson is looking forward to in Syria is the day when the Syrian people in a UN-supervised elections will vote Assad out. This was one of the big messages of the speech. Everything would be sorted when this UN process took place, and that is part of the Russian plan as well, that there are to be UN-supervised free and fair elections in Syria in due course. But the subtext of Tillerson's speech was that, sure, Assad can be a candidate in those elections, but we're going to try and rig them so that he loses. We're going to try and do that in two ways. One, by insisting that the Syrian diaspora, and we know they're not fans of Assad, can vote. And secondly, we're going to hold a gun, an economic gun, to the head of the Syrian people. We're saying no lifting of sanctions, no international aid, as long as you keep Assad. So, you know, vote for our guy.
I think Ambassador Ford is right.
Regime change.
Yeah, yes. It's another form. The U.S. has not given up on regime change. Bottom line, the other policy failed, but they're not stopping. And certainly the presence of the U.S. is to be a player at the table dictating the terms of the post-war government. I think Ambassador Ford is right that Tillerson, the U.S., all sectors, whether they're fighting about this or that within the U.S. establishment about tactics in Syria, they all agree on the objective that Assad must go. Ambassador Ford, you get the last word, 30 seconds.
Well, the big one that's being overlooked here is Iran. Iran is not going to leave Syria for as long as there are U.S. boots on the ground. I'm not sure if the Tillerson plan takes that into account, but I think very soon that reality will be brought home to all concerned.
Yeah, I think all parts of the American establishment suffer from the arrogance of power, leads you to a drunken state where you think that you actually can determine all things. We're out of time. We've been joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.